it.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you so much for your help.
Good morning. Sorry about the delay and getting things started, just some technical difficulties. I would like to thank Ms. Barnett for her suggestion related to the room changing and to the speaker. I think it's going to work out a lot better. So, does everyone have a copy of the minutes now? Any changes? Would someone like to make a motion?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you. Minutes are approved. DAWS program analysis. Oh, wait, we've got something first. There's an item on here related to comments or overview from the chairs. Jenny, can we bring up the Bagley thing, the Bagley section? Mm-hmm. Or do we need to come back to that?
I think we need to come back to that. Sorry.
Okay, no.
Yeah, could you please?
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. Okay. DWS program analysis, roadblocks for women. So one of the things that we had talked about from day one in one of our charges is to evaluate government programs and systems to see where we may have inadvertent public sector barriers to excellence. Sometimes as we develop statutory infrastructure, and as we implement that infrastructure, and as we interface with other levels of government, both local and federal, we create good things, good tools for people to succeed, and sometimes because of lack of communication or whatever, we can create roadblocks. And so we wanted to take a look at some of the issues particularly related to child care and other things. This is important to the speaker to see where we could improve on those public sector opportunities or barriers. So, Tracy.
Oh,
would it be okay if Carla Aguirre presents first for DWS and I'll follow?
I think that would be wonderful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carla, for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm excited about being able to give you some ideas about some of the roadblocks we have with policy, federal policy, and maybe some self-imposed things that we need to work on. So hopefully I'll give you what you are looking for today. I'm the program director for our program policy for our Workforce Development Division, and I'm the TANF administrator. So I'm mostly going to talk about TANF today. And so if you don't know what TANF means, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, it's our block grant we get from the feds, and I think that's probably one of our barriers for women obtaining education for a very, for longer than a short period of time, which is what the feds are doing to us right now. So let me start with that, and then I'll talk a little bit about the Workforce Investment Act. Would that be okay? Thank you. So currently, if you're not familiar with the TANF block grant, we have a work participation requirement. And Utah never missed their work participation requirement. We've always met that. The requirement right now is that 50% of your population is participating in activities that the federal block grant has defined as activities that count. The problem that we have with education is because of the way they count those participation hours, work participation hours, only 12 months count as full-time participation. Then what happens is they have to be, if they want to go into school longer than 12 months, they have to be doing other what they call priority activities. So then only 10 hours count on the work participation hours, and you have to combine it with other priority activities that the federal government has said this is a priority activity. We we think that that's not the right approach for our families, is that we ought to be doing the right thing and letting them go to school longer. That's as a state, we address those individually with our customers, and because of our caseload reduction credits, we have some room to do that, to be more flexible. But that is the law. And then after the 24 months, they really are supposed to be engaged in full-time employment and or activities that lead to full-time employment, like work search, job search. But there's a lot of competing requirements in order for them to count. So if we just said, if someone could participate full-time in activities for that individual to be able to either go to school or vocational training, and they were participating full-time, that's what we would like to do for our Utah families. But we are held to our participation rates. There are other states that are sanctioned because they don't hit their 50%. We've never been in that situation. But it does limit us, and sometimes we're frustrated by those activities. I think we have an opportunity, and hopefully there are people that will help us with this. And Senator Hatch has reached out to us. Is what kinds of things do we need to do when we do welfare reform? TANF reauthorization just keeps getting pushed down the line. I don't know if anybody's kept in with that. We got reauthorized till December again. It'll probably get reauthorized again, but they've got to stop long enough to redesign the program for states to make it really work. But for women who want that need to go to school to support their families, and if they're on our cash assistance program, we're doing some creative things to try to get them into education for longer periods of time. But we also always balance that with the compliance of the Fed. So that's one of our roadblocks. Another roadblock is that when someone doesn't even have their high school diploma or GED.
Can I interrupt you?
Yes.
I just have a couple clarifying questions.
Sure. Thank you. It's complicated, and I wish I could. Mm-hmm. I can give you the piece of policy, but I don't know if you want that.
Thank you for validating.
It's very complicated.
So the education requirement is one that is federal?
Yes.
Okay. Is it a limit of 12 months or 24 months?
It limits the what counts. So it's not that there's a limit.
It just doesn't count.
It doesn't count for work participation, which is, as a state, we have to meet 50%. So if we ever...
When you say 50%, do you mean 50% of the participants?
50% of our participants,
okay,
have to be meeting the federal work participation rates, the activities that they have said count.
Okay, and only 12 months count?
Only 12 months count full time. So let's use me as an example. I want to go to school, and I also need help because I've got four kids, and I need help. I need cash assistance to help me, and I want to go to school to even get my associate's degree. I can really, as an employment counselor, I'm looking at the compliance, and we'll say, well, you can go for the first year, but then after that, you're going to have to combine your training or your education with some other activities. Some of those other activities are like you're going to have to work part-time, or you're going to have to be involved in a work-study program that's, you know, complements your education. You would have to do, let me look at these other things that you can be involved in. Self-employment. You'd have to do a work experience. You'd have to do an internship. So in order for it to count for more than 10, the full participation, after 12 months, I'm going to have to combine it with something.
So raising children at the same time as going to school full-time doesn't count after 12 months?
Not with the feds.
Can we as a state expand that opportunity?
And we have. We have. We actually, but it is limited, and that's a self-imposed limit, the 24 months. And the reason it's a self-imposed limit is because we only have 36 months with these families, which is a Utah time limit. The federal time limit is 5 years, and we can extend them after the 3 years if there's a hardship. But if you're going to go in and get even an associate's degree, there's prereqs. Many of our low-income families need basic skills. Some of them don't have their GED or high school diploma. So that's tacked on to the 2 years of training, and we have 3 years to have them finished. So we're doing that already when it makes sense. We need to do more of it. We've been in a real work-first philosophy, and we are moving to a more family-focused, work-focused, not work-first. Not that work doesn't matter. What we're about is helping people move along the continuum and really participate fully in activities that make sense.
And I appreciate
that.
I would say that raising children or elder care or interim care is also work. We just don't pay for it in our society when it's within the home. So I appreciate the fact that that's articulated in that way about things that make sense. Because if people aren't taking care of their families, then somebody does, and we end up paying anyway.
Right.
And so we have, and I appreciate your patience, too.
Oh, no,
I'm trying to.
It's very complicated.
Paint a picture of this. So we take another 12, we extend the 12 months that count into 24 months that count. Associate's degree typically take, 2 years? Bachelor's, 4.
Well, that's if you're going full time and you have no bumps in the road.
Right.
Typically, for our population, it takes longer for low income families, moms and dads. So
for me, it took longer.
Yeah, it took longer for me too.
Yeah. So there's
lots of reasons.
Many opportunities to take longer.
Right.
Does anyone else have any questions at this point? Since I already interrupted, Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you say it doesn't count, that phrase, it doesn't count for the state as a group or for an individual?
For an individual. So we have to report participation to the feds in our quarterly reports, and participation only counts in certain activities for certain. There's limits on time. So
right, but you say we need to have 50% of our client base, right, meeting the criteria.
Right.
But then you say it doesn't count as and apply it to an individual. So
okay.
I'm trying to figure out
why or how that all works. Okay.
Sounds like an individual requirement that then you're somehow translating into the requirement for the state. Which I'm just trying to navigate through what you're saying.
So when you apply for cash assistance and you are enrolled and on the caseload, the requirement from the block grant is that 50% of your entire population that you're serving, and we have many people that have mental health issues, they have young children, 50% of those individuals need to be participating in activities that count, that they've told us what count. So there's lots of things that count, but for education, it only counts for 12 months, and then it counts for 10 hours, but they have to combine it with something.
What do you mean by 10 hours? 10 hours in a special 40-hour work week?
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
So
okay,
the feds say 30 hours is considered full-time.
Okay, so it's a third.
Right. It's a third, right. So when I say individually, because we have caseload reduction credits that contribute to our participation rate, we have some flexibility to do what's right for some of these families that really need longer periods of time to complete their education. And so we do what's right for them. If we ever got to a point where we were bumping up against that 50%, we would need to change our strategy. Right now, because of, I think, our economy and for other factors, our caseloads have gone down. And so we have this caseload reduction credit. Very, very complicated. But so what we're doing is we're trying to do what we wanted to do when we wanted to propose a waiver for Utah is let us help families become self-sufficient in the activities that work for them and let us get the outcome instead of holding us to these quite rigid activities that the feds say count. So that's we're kind of doing that because we've got the ability to do that because of our caseload reduction credits. I wish I could, if I had a board, I could probably write this out for you a little bit better, but it is complicated to, for staff as well, to understand what counts and what doesn't. So we tell them not to worry about what counts and what doesn't. Right now, we want them to have families participate fully with us.
You mentioned a potential waiver.
We had a potential waiver in written, and we did not push it forward. There were some things going on with the feds, and they said that states really weren't allowed to ask for waivers about work participation. I don't know.
That's not under federal law.
Apparently not. I don't know. I think that they will reauthorize TANF, and I think this is the one thing that that all states would push for because every state has this issue.
Okay, so there is no state right now that's functioning on what you're describing as
a waiver.
This waiver.
No. They may be doing that like we're doing that because we have the ability to do it with our caseload reduction credits. But places like California, they're in sanction right now because they're not meeting their requirements.
Are they holding back their money?
They hold back money.
In a perfect world, what you described is essentially a block grant.
Yeah.
Right? A block grant to the states with accountability measures and outcome measures at the end.
Yes. With guidelines about what counts. If they would say to us, you need people to participate fully. If you're going to provide assistance to them, you want them to be engaged with you, and we agree with that. Utah's always been a full participation state, even before this came into place. But for them to tell us what counts and what will count and what doesn't, our customers and our participants are individuals. They come into us with a lot of different levels. Certainly, there are some that just need to finish their education, but if we're looking at low-income families that really need to be able to be self-sufficient or self-reliant, they need education. I mean, even for high school diploma or GED, only 10 hours a week count. We can't put people in going back to school for 10 hours and that's all that count. That doesn't putting them on a work site doesn't really get them where they need to be. So that is a huge, that's a block for us. It's a federal mandate.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple other things just for you, unless there's other questions about that particular piece of policy.
Ms. Barnett?
Let me just use this as an example, a little challenge here. So if I have four children and I enter an apprenticeship, and I'm getting assistance from you now. Mm-hmm. Now I've decided to enter into an apprenticeship program where I may be able to receive my associate's degree. Entering into that program, I'll also be working.
Yes.
I may work full-time or I may work part-time. Is there a cap on the amount of money that I may make in order to stay on assistance with you?
Yes. And apprenticeship is one of those activities that counts as a priority service. But as soon as I start bringing income in, then it counts against your grant.
Yeah,
it does.
Thank you.
A couple of other things that are kind of barriers.
We've got a couple more questions.
Okay, sorry, I can't tell who's got your questions. Sorry about that.
Ms. Buckholzer.
Yes, just a follow-up question about the education piece. If only 12 months full-time is authorized initially,
mm-hmm.
before that needs to be combined with other activities, and there's a 3-year limit mm-hmm. in Utah for assistance, do you have any information that indicates how many women who started educational programs were unable to finish them within Utah time limits because of this federal requirement?
I don't have that with me, but I'm sure I can get that for you. One of the things is that if we know they can't finish, we don't put it on their employment plan. That's the other problem, is if we know that there's not enough time with the time limits, we don't want to set somebody up to start school and not be able to continue to support them. And I think it's something that's difficult for caseworkers when someone comes in and says, I really would like to get my bachelor's degree. Well, you aren't even going to be on our program that long, so I can't put that on your employment plan. So I think it is a problem. And if we put it on their employment plan, then how are they going to finish their last year if they're relying on the cash assistance or the child care or the other supportive services to get through school? So I can tell you how many it had. I can tell you about those that we put in school that they hit the time limit if it was in their time frame to go, because sometimes things happen. And we just had an individual that was in a well-being program, and she hit her time limit. We gave her a 6-month extension into the hardship, but then she had to quit because there's no rule around that. She'd hit her time limit. So we brought her back on and put her into our pilot program, which allows us to let them go up to 5 years if they need to be, and now she'll be able to finish. But that's not in our next generation kids pilot up in Ogden. But those are the kinds of federal guidelines that hurt our families, and particularly women, from completing school. But I could get that for you if you'd like. What period of time would you like us to get that data for you?
I mean, I think trend information is good. So if we could look at even 3 years, because we've got at least two problems here. One is putting women who need and want education into opportunities that will help them gain education. And so we know that there are women who are not being given that opportunity because requirements suggest that they won't even be able to finish. So why should we even get them started?
Correct.
So there's that barrier, and then there's the barrier of finishing for those women who begin. So I'm just curious, because we, from the way you describe it, we do have an important a couple of structural barriers here to one of the most important opportunities that women need access to.
So the other thing I was going to describe, what she just talked about, is a 36-month time limit. So that is a state. There are some states that only have 24 months, but many of them do the full 5 years. So that is something that's self-imposed by this legislature.
If I heard you, or if I'm interpreting what I think you said correctly, so we won't even start people, women, on education programs like for a bachelor's. Is that a federal requirement or an administrative discretion choice or an administrative discretion act of this state?
Because they can't finish, you've got to have a plan for employment. I mean, we want them to be employed at the end of their interaction with us. That's an outcome.
Absolutely. Is that a federal law, or is that this administrative decision? Because there are many ways to get funding for education. Some of them appear are available, or one becomes eligible when one is in the process. Just because our system or our TANF dollars and our state supplement would not fully go through the 4 years doesn't mean that there wouldn't be any opportunities.
I agree.
So
I think it's a self-imposed, but I don't want to say that 100% until I look at the federal guidelines and see. Because it has to be federal, it has to be state imposed, because all states have different time limits.
it sounds to me, even though I'm not looking at any code of federal regulations or our statutes, that we are using that as an act of administrative discretion. And what is very disconcerting about that to me is that through those choices, we are denying people opportunities. I mean, that doesn't make sense to me. Paying for school it can be very difficult, and it can be very challenging. And I know this because I've had to work myself through school as undergraduate, and then so on and so forth. And again, sometimes scholarships or sometimes other things come about when we are in the midst of a program and not just at the beginning.
Correct.
So that will be another really important follow-up item, please. Ms. Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple questions just to have a better understanding of the size of women, the group of women we're referring to. So I'm just wondering if you can share the amount of women that are involved in this program, as well as graduation rate, if you have that information. Thank you.
Our caseload right now is in the 4,000, a range 4,000. Let me get that for you. I don't want to give you just stuff off the top of my head. I want to make sure I give you accurate information. So I'll add it to the list and have Carrie make sure you get that. We do not have enough women in education in our program. I can tell you that. And that's because we've been a work first model. And so if someone has some work history and they've got their high school diploma, we're putting them in a work first approach. So we're backing out off of that because of our caseload reduction credits. And what we're learning is now with the economy, people that women that are coming in to get services really have a lot of barriers. And obviously education is one of them. I'm taking up all the time. Are you guys okay on time?
We need to be mindful of that. I think we're...
I think Tracy wants to talk about child.
The speaker does have another question. Ms. Thompson, were you?
That was all. I just wanted to make sure
get that
for you. I'm not sure if it's 5,000 women or 50,000. I'm not sure about the size and also the graduation rate. Thank you.
And graduation rate of higher ed or high school or
of those involved inside of the program, how many of those are actually obtaining a certification or
okay.
Madam Speaker.
Thank you. The 36-month time limit that Utah has, is that a universal, applies to everyone in all programs at all times for all things, or are we allowed to have subgroups, like have different time limits for different groups?
Well, I think we could do whatever we wanted to, but we have to be, I think, fair about how we approach that, and so for people to go beyond that 36 months in rule is the hardship clause. So if there's things that are going on, we extend them. I don't know if we can federally, as a state, say, for women or for people in school, can they go beyond? I think there's all sorts of things you can do. I know that federally you can't go past the 5 years. But
right, I understand the 5 year.
Right.
But the 3 year that Utah has chosen through policy, statute, however, I think maybe we should investigate what exactly that means.
Okay.
Does that mean, doesn't matter who you are, what your situation, whatever, at 3 years of cash assistance, whatever it is in particular we're talking about, it's done. That's it. It's over.
Right.
That's our hard thing, unless you have this hardship.
Right.
Well, maybe we need to look at subgroups. If you are actively engaged in passing and, educational attainment, maybe that
I love
that
idea.
Needs to change, right? And is
right.
that statutory, or is that, it sounds like there's already an administrative hardship mm-hmm. extension.
Right. Right.
And is that administrative? Is that something that can come from the executive branch? Is that allowed in the statute? That's one of the things that
anything
I
think it
out.
Could be allowed, but I can do some research on that as well. That's a very good idea.
Thank you.
Ms. Irene and then Dr. Robinson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. To Ms. Thompson's question about scope of this block grant, I'm curious as to the amount that each family receives. So if there are 4,000 people in the program, do they all receive the equal amount of funds, or is that administratively decided also?
Well, their cash assistance is based on family size. So their grant that they get every month is based on a family size.
So a family of four, what would the grant be?
I think it's $395, I think.
So I don't...
Let's see if I've got that.
$395 a month?
Per child?
Yeah, I think
or per family.
No, per family.
I think that's important for us to have a better understanding of how the program can really be helpful. $395 a month for a family of four is not going to go far in helping education attainment
but if you're helping your
electric bill.
Right, but if you're providing supportive services to that family as well, to help them while they're, if it's on their plan to go to school, we can help pay for school. We can help pay for supportive services. Like if there's a, if they need a bus pass to get to school, or if they need parking for the school, those are all eligible funding things beyond their cash assistance that we can support them with. So that's why it's a good program, because even though the cash assistance is based on family size, there are all these additional things that we can provide to them if they're participating and moving along and achieving the goals. You know, they can't go to school and then fail if they, you know, if they're not invested in that. But there are many, many other things we can do to provide supportive services to that customer.
And is there a just a quick follow-up question, is there a coordination of services through your group that helps them figure out other ways to get it done?
Right. We have a, we talk to them about budget. We help them with budget is when they first come in. But yeah, there's a whole strategy around that.
Okay.
And I will get you the income guidelines so you know what the cash assistance is. I actually think I think it's $395 for a family of three, not four.
Okay, thank you.
I didn't know you'd want all that stuff. I should have brought it.
Thank you. Dr. Robinson.
Okay, thank you. We probably didn't know we wanted it. I have a question, then I have a follow-up comment. If a person receives a scholarship or a grant, such as a Pell Grant, to go to school, does that impact their cash assistance through TANF?
There's a lot of exemptions, and I think Pell Grant's one that doesn't impact them.
And scholarship, either a needed
scholarship
or academic
scholarship? I don't think so, but I can't tell you that for sure. I know that we just talked about this for 529 for kids, that do those accounts, saving accounts, count, and they do not. So there's a lot of things that don't count as income for those families. Yeah.
And then I'm really concerned about this prohibition that you can't count education if they cannot complete a degree within a certain time frame. And the comment I'd like to share with the group is, even if you don't complete a degree, some amount of education will help with employment outcomes.
Yes. And we know that.
I know you do. I know you do. And everybody on the team. So it really causes me concern to have such a limitation.
Yep.
Please come to me.
Okay, just two other little things. And we talked about the 36 months, because I think that is something I really like Speaker Lockhart's idea. Could we do groups? And I don't know, but I think we should explore that. There's also limits on the high school and GED, which is even more limited than going to higher education, and that is only 10 hours to count. We've done several projects where we want them to get in and get their high school diploma or GED so they can move on, and we've let them go full-time. They're not counting towards our work participation credits. And that's okay, because we're okay. But that piece of policy federally needs to be changed as well. That's just one other. And then there's a couple of other things that I won't mention, and it's just about job search. I don't know about you guys, but when you're finished with school, how long did it take you to get a job? And when I went to school, I got my degree in education, and it took me a long time to get a teaching job. So if I was on the program, I have to do something, which I did anyway, but you would have to do something else, because only 4 weeks of job search counts. That's another kind of barrier at the end of the training. And these are all federally designed priority activities that count.
The speaker has a couple follow-ups. Class, we're not sure that we heard
that
correctly. It doesn't make sense. Yeah, can you repeat that second one? The second one you just said. My whole mind was still back on the GED thing.
So you're talking about the work search activity?
Yes,
okay.
The work search activity.
So actually, 6 weeks, let me make sure I've got this right. You can only look for a job and account for participation for 4 weeks at a time. And then you have to have a break. So you have to do something else if you're going to count.
and then you can come back, and it's actually only, make sure, only 360 hours count, and then it doesn't count anymore in the job search piece. So it's very complicated. And
so what do you guys expect you to do in this takeoff, in this journey taking
people,
off?
We do whatever we need to do. They just don't count. But if at some point when they reauthorize this, if they can make this so that it makes sense for our customers and for our staff, we jiggle things around just so we can get participation rates. And it's not right.
Okay, and then the GED and high school completion, you said that pursuing that doesn't count?
It only counts for 10 hours.
10 hours a week?
A week. And so they have to be involved in 20 other hours in a priority activity in order for it even to count at all. Because if they're only getting their high school diploma, and that's all they're working on, whether they're going full-time or not, even the 10 hours don't count unless you combine it. You combine it with those other activities, like the second year of education.
So aren't there, like, even online or other courses for GED completion that are fairly rapid but fairly intense?
Yes. And we put them in that. But if they can't do anything else but go to school and to get that, they just don't count. But we're doing the right thing. Work participation doesn't. Work participation rates do not.
So, and these are federal requirements.
Federal requirements.
That are holding people back. That we could provide them the service of, here's a rapid 3-week, 4-week.
Right.
When you're done with this, you're going to have your GED
right.
and you're more qualified for a higher paying
right.
job, whatever. Or we'll get you into higher education. We can do that, but it's going to be really tough because we can only really sort of use 10 hours a week of it.
But we can't even count the 10 hours unless you add 20 hours in other activities. That's the other problem. They have to participate fully in 30 hours, okay? So I'm going to school. I'm going to high school.
Yeah.
And I'm going full-time because I dropped out. Let's say that. I'm going full-time. How am I going to put in 20 other hours in a work site or, a part-time job? I might have a part-time job, but it's going to take me longer to finish my school if that's the case. For some people, they need to have that income, and they choose to do that. But for other individuals, we need to put them in and get their GED or high school diploma first, full-time. And then we just don't worry about it because they're participating,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't count with the feds as participation.
When you mentioned counselors, are these
employment counselors?
Is this the opposite of the unemployment system where it's all online, or are there people interacting with our citizens and clients?
Mm-hmm. For our family employment program,
we have people.
We have employment counselors that do case management that work intensely with them. Yeah.
Okay. This is there are many issues trying to get our hands and minds wrapped around this, and I am just hopeful that we at least provide a helpful human experience with people who have entered into our system.
We try to.
Okay.
I can't tell you that everyone does that because, I'll be honest, I mean, some of our employment counselors are really compliance-driven. We're trying to help them.
But they're people, right? I mean,
yes.
People and
absolutely.
Not. Okay.
Because they have to get their outcome. They have to get those positive closures.
Thank you.
So I think it might be helpful if I lay this out in a document for you with all your questions that you wanted, and we'll make sure that you get that as follow-up information. And it's hard when we're training brand new counselors on how this works. I'll try to put it in a way for you that makes it easy for you to follow because it's not easy. So I know you might be confused about that combination piece, but that's what we're faced with.
Thank you, Ms. Burkhalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really sympathize with what you are faced with. I have another question, and maybe Ms. Gruber is going to be addressing this, and that is these requirements to be either in school or employed. It's the 30-hour-a-week mm-hmm. requirement. So I think another issue that this commission will be interested in hearing is the assistance for women with children in terms of child care and transportation.
If they're on employment, the family employment program and going to school, we can provide child care because it's part of their employment plan. But what Tracy's going to talk to you about is those individuals going to school that need child care assistance, and it's not available right now. So
just as a follow-up, a woman, in order to receive child care assistance through DWS, would need to be either becoming educated or working for at least 30 hours a week. Is that correct?
I'll let her talk about the child care piece of that. But
Thank
for
you.
The family employment program, it just needs to support the child care based on the employment plan. So if my employment plan says I'm going to school full-time, I can provide child support, child care for that full-time training program and for time that they're studying, whatever that school institution say it says is full-time. Our Workforce Investment Act also does training. That's a self-imposed 24-month. I did want to mention that. We can open that up, but part of that is just about funding, the limits we have on funding. So, any other questions?
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me today. I'm Tracy Gruber. I'm the Director of the Office of Child Care within the Department of Workforce Services, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak about what Utah has within the Office of Child Care to support working families and families that are pursuing education while they have children in the home and they're unavailable to care for them. In the interest of time, I will not go through everything, and I think there's probably a lot of questions, so I'll try and keep my comments brief and allow an opportunity for questions. The Office of Child Care does have two primary goals. One is to support parents while they're working and unable to be at home to care for their children. We also provide an opportunity to ensure that when they are in child care settings, that the children are cared for in a developmentally appropriate setting that will prepare them for school, and if they're already in school, continue to support them as they pursue their education. We do this two primary ways. We provide subsidies for low-income families so that they can go get child care for their children, and then we also have a component of our program that provides grants for child care providers to improve the settings that the kids are in a variety of ways, and most of those are through grants, and they're competitive and non-competitive grants depending on what they are. Our funds are through the Child Care Development Block Grant, which is also a block grant program from the federal government. It provides a great amount of flexibility to design the program to meet the needs of families that are eligible for it. I think the biggest issues confronting women and families that are working in terms of child care have to do with three specific issues. One has to do with work schedule volatility, and I'll talk a little bit about that. The other is, I'm just going to skip to my notes. Many of our families have experienced trauma and difficulties when they were children, and even though we want them to pursue jobs and education, a lot of these families have challenges in leaving their kids with providers, and I think that that's a significant challenge for our population. And Carla mentioned the issue of education and child care, and we are confined to limitations on providing child care support and education. We can do it in terms of the family employment program, but right now our subsidies are to eligible families that are employed or else in the family employment program, and they have to have 15 hours a minimum of work and income criteria in order to receive that subsidy. Just briefly on work schedule volatility, a lot of our families, as Carla mentioned, the education attainment level of this population is extremely low, which that impacts their ability to obtain certain jobs and what sectors they're employed in. And most of our women are employed in low-wage job sectors, primarily service sectors. That means that their work schedules are very volatile. We're seeing sporadic. Sometimes these women go to their employer for work, and the employer said, we don't need you today, so go home. They've already dropped their child off for childcare. They've already paid for childcare, and that causes a lot of problems. They've made arrangements for their kids. The provider doesn't want them not to pay for that day because their entire budget is based on having that child in childcare. And I think work schedule volatility is a very serious issue for this population. And there are things that probably could be done. This obviously would require a lot of involvement with the business community, not just us, to have a conversation about how we adjust for work schedule volatility. And it's something that I think is very important. The other thing is that we don't have an infrastructure in the childcare community that supports non-traditional work hours. So swing shift work hours, 24-hour schedules. There's a very, very small population of providers within the state of Utah that provides childcare during those hours. And what that means is these families are going to get their childcare from family members, from neighbors. And the research has shown not all situations are those settings preparing them for these children for school. So I wouldn't say that across the board, but it's more likely to happen in that type of childcare setting than in a centered setting. And this is just something that's really important to consider. In terms of education, I already mentioned we just are not providing childcare support for women who are pursuing an education unless they're in the family employment program. Their employment counselor says you can pursue your education and we'll give you childcare to help you do that, and then you're bumping up against all those other obstacles and barriers that are imposed through the family employment program. So those are what I see the three biggest challenges for the population of women that the Department of Workforce Services sees, and the role that the Office of Child Care plays in helping them move to self-sufficiency for their families and creating a safe place for their children to receive care and preparing them for their roles in education. And I'm happy to answer any questions. I do have data, maybe not for all of your data questions, but we certainly can get it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Speaker.
Thank you. Here's what I think we need. Here's what I need. I need, on the barriers, what is a federal barrier, either in federal law or federal policy, federal guidelines, administrative, whatever, right? So what is a federal barrier versus what is a state barrier? And then on the state barriers, is it a statutory barrier or is it an administrative barrier? Because we'll address, but we can address all of those things obviously in different ways. If it's an administrative barrier, that's an executive branch issue that we can, the legislative branch, we can put pressure on, we can work with the executive branch, those kinds of things, express our want to see, our desire to see that change. We can do that. If it's statutory, a legislature can change the statute, clearly. Bills can be run, things like that can change. If it's federal, then at this point, we're talking advocacy, right? Either with the agencies or directly with Congress through our federal delegation. So if you can...
Sure, thanks.
List what those are in which area... be incredibly helpful.
Since it's a block grant, most of these barriers, especially in terms of education, is a state barrier. It's not just a state barrier. We also have resource issues because we get the block grant, and the state does put up a certain percentage in order to show the maintenance of effort, but the state isn't putting any more towards that. So when you're talking about how you're going to split the amount of the grant that's going to subsidy and what you're going to pay for, you're up against resource limitations in addition to
just an administrative barrier.
Is that that affects match rate, obviously. I mean, obviously, you put more up, you get more match, right? Because there's more state dollars, more federal dollars. You're referring to that?
Well, there's two components for the Child Care Block Grant, just to add more confusion. The mandatory component of the block grant is the subsidy component, and there is a maintenance of effort part of that that we do
match.
It's not a match.
Medicaid.
Then we have a discretionary part of the Child Care Development Block Grant that requires a match. The state budget doesn't provide any matching dollars. We use other entities for our match, like community programs and county government that are doing after-school programs, and we can use our match to draw down our full grant amount.
Okay.
So we're pulling down our entire subsidy
okay.
amount.
So this is another clarification that the legislature will need, and that is... what are the limitations that the legislature is placing on flexibility based on line item allocations as opposed to what the executive branch is deciding to do and directing the appropriated revenue internally? Is that, am I making sense?
Yes. And I think that's something that we can definitely look at. That might raise issues with the federal government. When you look at the subsidy component of our grant and the discretionary component of our grant, I don't know yet if we have the latitude to move over discretionary money to support that subsidy component.
Right, and that's information that we need to know.
Yes.
Right, so is this again, something that the legislature is perpetuating a barrier based on the way that we budget in line item, which gives you no flexibility or limited flexibility, as opposed to here's the money, it's appropriated, and the agency is making decisions as to how to allocate it.
Yeah,
and then internal issues.
Right. And I'm following, and I can get some clarification on that, so actually I understand it better as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
That was all that I had for my presentation, and just wanted to provide an opportunity to answer questions.
Okay. Does anyone else have any questions? Okay, great.
Thank you
so much. We'll circle back related to the follow-up. Thank you for your time here today, and it was raised earlier about that we hadn't thought of some of the questions earlier. I mean, the process is iterative, so it's not a criticism of anyone for not having things readily at their fingertips. What it is a compliment because you've raised some good discussion points. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
STEM Action Center.
Morning.
Good morning.
Can I get my head in my presentation? This conversation was a good one.
Very interesting and thought-provoking. And I'll just make a quick comment. We're a lot behind schedule, and I'm making that for the whole group. It's the balance of being able to be respectful of everyone's time and have meaningful conversation. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thanks for having me. And I'll just wing it a bit here and just get to the punchline. So the STEM Action Center is a number of you on the board, the commission already know, part of our mission is to help create more coordination and therefore more meaningful and intentional collaborations so that we can leverage the resources that we have already existing in the state for STEM education and workforce alignment. And we're not just a K-12, we're a K-grade. As we originally, our intent was in the earliest discussions of the STEM Action Center and this initiative at a state level. Because if you believe the data, both on a national, regional, and here, you know, from our companies here, there's a strong need for STEM education. The salaries are 26% higher than non-STEM workers. And this is by no means to marginalize non-STEM based career pathways. That's not the point here. It's just we can't boil the ocean. We are about STEM, and that's what we're doing. So one of the things that's been going around, I think we all know intuitively and probably from personal experience, that mentors are a big deal, a very big deal. And I know that after Carrie Maines asked me to come and talk about this project that I'd like to propose to the commission for some vision and leadership on, I started thinking about my own mentors and who could have helps me decide where I wanted to be. And I thought, you know, I'm still getting mentors today. There are people in this community that still I consider mentors. And so that mentoring is not only important for our young girls, but for all of us in the workplace sometimes to figure out, you know, how to best leverage resources that we have at our disposal. And so what I want to propose is that there's been a lot of discussion over the last several years from many very committed and passionate groups of people, such as the Women's Technology Council, about how do we do a better job of coordinating, collaborating, creating a network of support for our, not only our young girls, but our professional women in mentoring situations. And what I'd like to see is that we do a better job working together to do that. And something came up, I've been looking high and low for good models, best practices. How do other states do this? Are they doing it well? Are they struggling as much as I feel like we do sometimes? And there was a national initiative that just emerged about a year ago called Million Women Mentors out of STEM Connector in Washington, D.C. They're a national organization. And in light of time, what I'll do is, if it's okay, I'll send you the presentation and you can look at it on your own, you know, when you have more time. But what I'd like you to do is look at this as the endpoint. It's a national initiative. They're looking at state-by-state commitment and involvement on a pledge basis. So states are pledging in the next 4 years to have X number of men and women mentors targeting young girls and women in the workplace. And I think in our situation, I'd like to start with young girls, you know, in middle school, high school, post-secondary. But to look at that as our endpoint, our goal, and then to back engineer a program and a framework in which a couple things need to fall into place, in my opinion, and it's just what it's worth, 5 cents maybe. Vision and leadership, the creation of a framework, and that framework needs to be built based on what we already have so that we don't lose the investments that a lot of people have made in trying to build certain types of network, you know, mentoring projects, and see what we don't have, so that we can start building that with some support. Worker bees, we need some worker bees to pull this off. Instead of just talking, let's do this, let's pull this off. Let's decide what that mentoring looks like. Is it online? Is it face-to-face? Is it the traditional paid internship model, job shadowing? What does that look like? And that should be based on what we already have and what we need. And so what I'd like to propose to this commission today, if it's possible, is when there's more, we can put together a proposal where the commission may perhaps provide the vision and the leadership to help guide this and provide input. And I will commit from the STEM Action Center, working with some of our partners out there, such as the Women's Tech Council, to provide the worker bees, the people on the ground, to pull it off. And working with this commission to continue to give it the vision and leadership that we'll need to have the best impact we can with our young girls. I came prepared, you know, prepared to do more of a presentation, but that's the punchline today. I'm hoping I can get you interested enough to let us come back maybe with more time with a real plan. Today was just about kind of the rah-rah. Can we work together and have this commission perhaps give us vision leadership and all bring together the people that can help put the pieces in place with your guidance and leadership? Matt, we'd rather like to have some discussion if we can, if there's a few minutes. I do believe really quickly, though, that mentoring is a big deal. And I see an absence of it when we go out to our schools with our young girls, particularly in middle school. I dare say our boys probably need it just as much as our girls do, but this commission is about women in the economy. But I do believe there's a lot of committed people out there we could rally around if we could create a coordinated framework and leadership around that. Any questions?
We do. We've got some, and thank you. And amplify your point about the importance of mentoring. I mean, it's there in the literature, it's there in lived experience, not only related to business and economy, but also in participation politically as well, and community involvement. And so there are a lot of shared threads there. And this tool, this potential tool, if the committee members decide that this is something that we want to pursue, I think can help us reach a lot of the goals that we have identified in our outcome plan. So, with that, Ms. Barnum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am very passionate about this subject, and I'm really excited to have you here, and certainly looking forward to a continued partnership. My question is, you said that you're looking into what best practices there are in other states. Who's doing this really well, and what are they doing with this type of mentor program that you think would work really well in Utah?
That's a million-dollar question, and I think what we would like to do in the next month is to do a deep dive working with the STEM Connector group that's put together Million Women Mentors and put together a 1 to 2 page report on what is going on in other states and how does that compare and contrast what we're doing in Utah. Because the short answer to your question, I really don't know, but I'm extremely curious. I think we need to know that, because why reinvent the wheel? There's some good things going on in Utah. They could be better if we were coordinated, if we put some metrics and outcomes on some of these efforts so that we know if it's really working. I don't know about anyone in this room, but we're all limited in time. We certainly want to make sure that what we do works and that we have data that shows that it works, the outcomes and the deliverables. So I can definitely put that together, and that's been one of the things I wanted to do. But I really think that for this to be important, when Carrie Main came to me and she said, you know, this might be something this commission would really want to help guide and give leadership to, I thought that's really what we need. If we're going to get people excited in the trenches to get this done, having good leadership and vision can help push it forward much more quickly. But so I'll bring that to you. We'll do a deep dive in the next month, and we can give you some more information on what states are doing and is it working? Do we have data?
Can I ask one follow-up, too? When you work with women or girls in this area, how much of the barriers do you think are just gender, cultural issues, and how much are them just not having interest in these types of fields?
That's a good question. That could be a couple hours, right? I mean, we could all, no, and I appreciate it. It's a great question. I think a lot of it is cultural. Anecdotally, we hear a lot of things from the girls in the sciences that, boy, wouldn't they love, these all-girls events, right? We have Expanding Your Horizons, the youth puts on all-girl events. And I've gone into these events and asked them, why do you do this? It's Saturday, it's priority. You keep doing other things. And like, well, you know, when we're at school and with the boys, they take over. And, you know, those are anecdotal. But I think that reflects a big portion of what happens for our young girls in schools. And if they have a little mentoring to say, hey, it doesn't have to happen that way. I think, you know, so that's the gender. I think culturally, I think you see that in all states to some extent. I don't think Utah is particularly unique in that from what I hear. But I think it's a little bit of culture. I think it's social norms. I think it's gender that runs into it. Just personalities that tend to come out with girls versus boys. It's a little bit of all of it. So just my opinion, what I've seen. Thank you.
Thank you. I would say it's more than anecdotal. I mean, there's literature that, yeah, that talks about what happens in groups and so forth. Thank you for your comment.
That's a great question.
Ms. Irene?
Thanks for coming and speaking to us on this topic. I, too, am very passionate. And part of my responsibilities in my job when I'm not here is recruiting. We have the fifth largest technology company. People don't normally assume that with Science Bank Corporation, but we're really very challenged to find good employees in general in these fields. Research is showing that by 2025, 70% of jobs will be technology or data-driven, that you'll have to have those skills. So reaching girls at this, when they're making career choices, I think is hugely impactful in helping them choose jobs that will provide equal wage issues will be dealt with. I think it's critical. My question is, I know that the Women's Technology Council would be very interested in partnering in a mentoring program. I think if you asked the majority of those women, 75-80% would say that they would mentor somebody. Much of mentoring, like Million Women Mentors, is done online. So if we could collaborate on making a presentation to those women about their time commitment, wouldn't have to be much because a lot of it is online, is based via email with these young women, and maybe they meet once or twice a month as a group, is typically the best way that I've seen it being able to disseminate from the top to the bottom.
And my game plan, to be honest, was to present to this commission first to see if you're interested. And if you were, then the next step would be to talk to the Women's Tech Council and see if they're willing to partner with us on a project like this.
Well, I'm interested, or I hope the chairs are.
I think we're all interested,
yeah.
I think. Are you all interested?
can't think of a better group of women to take this on, personally, knowing the work that some of you do. So it would be a big boost to us moving this forward. I've been looking for a way to create a network like this for our young girls, and the STEM Action Center it's in our mission. It's what we're supposed to be doing. So, I promise I'll get you something more tangible. I didn't want to presume too much today, other than just seeing if there was interest.
That's great. It's all iterative. Ms. Irene, did you have any follow-up?
Just raising my hand to help, really, in what help you need.
Yes. Okay. I think vision, leadership, guidance, your collective input, and how we should make this roll out would be perfect.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Barnett?
Thank you, Representative Seeley. I am really in favor of STEM. We have been following this program. I'm in favor of the Million Women Mentors. What I'd like to ask is that you come back with the time for the full presentation. I know you, is this a PowerPoint?
It is a PowerPoint, and like I said, I'd be more than happy to send it to you so that you can look at it, and then you can email me, call for more answers, but I can come back prepared to really put this in the full package as to how this will play into the Million. To be honest with you, Million Women Mentors, to me, is a national initiative that can help us as an endpoint, kind of a goal to set, but that really what we need is our Utah Women's Mentors, you know, to use this as that platform, that template to build off of backwards, to build our own network.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'd like to see that.
Okay. I'd be more than happy to do that.
Thank you. Do you have enough feedback to be able to do a deeper dive on?
I do.
For next time.
This is perfect. Thanks so much.
Great.
I appreciate your time.
Thank you. We appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Dr. Perlick.
I come bearing data.
So one of the goals that we have had or continue to have is to make sure that we have an accurate and correct view of the landscape here in Utah so that we can make a series of strategies to get to where we want to go. And this presentation today has been requested by several members and fits into what our charge is by providing an accurate picture of where it is that we want to go and the state of women, not only currently, but what we have coming down the road.
Plug and play. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to move to, is it over here? It's a more complicated system than I'm used to. Okay, so now we're moving to a static version on a PDF on a PC, so we'll see how that works. Always good to have a technology juggle. All right, so I've got a. Can everybody see my slides okay? Okay. Well, it feels like we're really low and looking over the top of rabbit holes. I can see everybody's head though.
Okay,
so how do I
feel like I need to bring a phone book? Yeah, a phone book.
We just need the power switch.
And this is a more friendly space.
This is a friendly space? Okay. So, yes, I come bearing data. This is a picture of the human genome, yeah. This is the genome map. And just to remind you that we have so much more data available to us than we've had ever before. And so the world is changing really dramatically, but so is our ability to gather data about it, and our ideas are changing too. So all of this is in motion, and I'm going to talk with you about really big picture trends, economy, technology, demography, and try to bring that back to gender issues. reminding you that if we look at data in real time, is this what they're seeing up here, this little scrunched one? Okay. If we look at data in real time, these are the populations of all of the Intermountain states up until 1950. And when we're looking at the data, a lot of times we're trying to figure out, well, what's important and what's not? And who, from the point of view of 1950, could have imagined that in this mere span of 60 years, we have this absolute explosion of population growth? So the point is, how do we determine, distill, which of the data is important and which of it is just a fad, or which of it is something that cyclically comes and goes? Well, I would argue this is one of the most important pieces of demographic data that we know, and that is that in 2010, the majority of births in our nation are minority children, and this is the leading edge of the minority-majority generation that will ever more characterize our nation. Another piece of data that's truly important is that in 2010, in the very depths of the recession, women were the majority of wage earners. This was because the recession was wiping out very good jobs, male jobs, manufacturing jobs, high-paying jobs with benefits, and that many women who had never intended to be sole breadwinners became sole breadwinners as a result of that. But hooray, the recession's over, so they tell us. This graph shows you, that red line shows you the depth of the job losses in the current recession as compared to all of the recessions in the post-World War II era, and the duration. So we're 5 years out on trying to get out of this recession now, as compared to all of those other recessions, show you the job losses and the duration. So this has been a very severe economic event. And what we see is that if you look at these data, that the jobs that were lost, you look in the lower left-hand corner, have been high-wage jobs. And to the right, the jobs that have been gained are part-time, low-wage jobs. So this has been a high-wage recession and a low-wage recovery. And what we also understand is that among advanced industrialized nations, we have a very unequal distribution of income and wealth. The bottom 50% of households have less than one-fifth of all of the income in the nation. The top 5% you see have over a third. But the important point then is to look on the next slide, is to look at what's happened to household incomes over the last 30 years or so. And so what we see is that the bottom 50% have incomes of just over $22,000, and that's been very flat. The middle, the great middle, the next 45%, that have had pretty flat incomes, and the top 5%, their incomes have gone up. And if we look at net worth, we can see the bottom 50% have basically no net worth. That this last recession, which has collapsed, the real estate collapse, has really hurt working families tremendously. And so you can see also that the share of net worth has declined, and mean net worth. This is the bottom 50%. These are half of the households in our nation have net worth, mean net worth of about $10,000. That's basically nothing. Meanwhile, if you look at net worths of the next 45% and the top 5%, you can see that for the middle, that next 45%, there's been it's a slight increase. The top 5% is increasing. So for the majority of households, they're struggling. They have no real net worth, and incomes have been very flat and stagnating. We know it's our connections to the outside world through economy and technology and new people coming to Utah that have changed who we are. And Utah has changed in demography too. And this is really sort of the heart of what I wanted to show you. And that is that we have immigrants, of course, coming in large numbers, that we have the aging of the baby boom, and that our fertility rates have fallen significantly. If we look at age at first marriage, a lot of times people say, well, now women are getting, age at first marriage is a lot older than it used to be. But it, like so many other data that we look at, this is a U-shaped curve. And we see that we go back to 1890, age at first marriage was 26 for men and 22 for women. It declined to 1960, and now it increases. So it's not a trend. It's that we would drive backwards in time and find women getting younger and younger in marriage. This is a U-shaped curve. What does that tell us? that tells us that marriage, household formation, education, number of children, all of it is interconnected to the conditions that people find it, their lives situated in, that it's not a sort of an atomized or individuated decision. Look at fertility rates. Okay, so now, this is very important. This is what I want you to remember. Utah has a higher fertility rate than Mexico right now. That's because Mexico has a replacement level of fertility of 2.1. We're at 2.4. But look at the dramatic decline from 4.3. The days of women in Utah routinely having 4, 5, 6 children are gone. We are at a fertility rate of 2.4. And you can see that we're trending down, as is the nation. The household sizes were the largest in the nation, but you can see we've declined significantly. Median age, we're the youngest in the nation, but we're increasing. Minorities as a share of the population, lower than the nation, but increasing. If we look at all of the diversification that's occurred among our population, age diversity, ethnic diversity, racial diversity, linguistic diversity, we also need to keep in mind that there are increasingly diverse household arrangements, multi-generational households, single-parent households. You find all kinds of living arrangements, grandparents as caregivers. And here we see that the share of households that are what are called the family households have gone down both in Utah and in the nation. The share of households with married couple with children, in Utah now is down to a third of households. It's 1 in 5 nationally. All these trends are affecting Utah. So if we think about policy that privileges one particular type of family or household arrangement, it is now leaving out 2/3 of households, is what this is showing us. And then if we look at how race and ethnicity are expressed then in labor market outcomes for women in particularly, and these are from the YWCA's well-being index work, then we can see that labor force participation rates of Hispanic women and other minority women are higher than for white women. We can see that median earnings for Hispanic women and for other minority women are significantly lower than for white women. We can see that the poverty rates for minority women are higher than for white women, and these are the most rapidly growing parts of our population, our diverse populations. And again, if we look at that earnings gap, which is at 67% of men's compared to women for white women, then you can see that Hispanic women are well under half, and other minority women at 58%. So, you know, this really is the new Utah really emerging before our very eyes. I haven't in my work, which I didn't mention to you that I'm a PhD economist and that I've built my practice here in Utah, becoming an expert in applied, I'm an economic demographer and becoming an expert in Utah demographic trends. I've recently extended my work to more explicitly address gender issues, as those have become obvious to me as something that requires more attention. But we do have this transformation going on, as we can all see. Here are minorities as a share of the population, which, if we run the numbers out into the future, we see that the nation becomes minority-majority in about 2040. That's about a generation and a half of faster than Utah, but you can see that Salt Lake City is right on path. So that we have areas within and neighborhoods within Utah that with very, very different conditions. So this diversity I've been talking with you about, the averages that you see at the state level, they really mask a very much more complex array or tapestry of diversity that we find throughout neighborhoods and throughout the state of Utah. And I'll show you some of that later. This shows you minorities as a share of age group out of the 2010 census. So these are 5-year age groups. So you've got preschool on the bottom left, then 5 through 9 and 10 through 14. And you can see of every 5-year age group and top coded at 85 years and older. And what that shows you is that in Utah as a whole, about 1 out of 4 preschoolers is a minority kid. In Salt Lake County, it's 35% of preschoolers are minority kids. And if you look in the nation, it's 49%. And if you look in Salt Lake City, and I could be talking Ogden or Orem, it's 50% of preschool-age kids. And if you look in the River District of Salt Lake City, or if you look in the downtown of Ogden, or after in many neighborhoods throughout the state, 75 to 80% of the kids are minority kids. And over to the right, then, you see the old white baby boomers that we are, with no immigration and not very diverse. And as we are still sort of driving the policy train, so to speak, we must remember that our experiences in our own lifetimes is a slice of human history, and that our experiences, in fact, are very, very different than the next generation that's coming, the mighty millennials, as I call them. Right now, in the homes of our school kids, there are reportedly 129 languages spoken. That's here in Utah. And so we have this great generational shift, and you see this in all of the polling research, too. The sensibilities of this generation are so different than the older generation. For example, the old white baby boomer that I am, remembering in Tulsa, where I was brought up, the whites-only signs on drinking fountains and in public facilities, and watching the replays of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, I Have a Dream speech, which I keep a copy of on my wall in my office. I never could imagine an African-American president. The kids today in second grade have only known an African-American president. These generational shifts reverberate across a wide range of issues. Again, when you get to the neighborhood level, the picture is even more diverse. I mentioned to you that family households, married couple family households, opposite sex with children, are about a third of households. Look in Salt Lake County today, you can see that that is around 20%. I can almost read that, 27%. And if you look at that in Utah County, that's a much higher percent. That's a 42%. If we look at the general fertility rate, which I told you is very low, now at 2.4, this is a different measure. But you can see downtown Salt Lake City, this is per 1,000 women in childbearing years, only 48.6 is the fertility rate. Then you look in Lehigh and Cedar Valley. These are screenshots, by the way, out of the Utah Community Data Project. It's our new online neighborhood information system, ucdp.utah.edu. Again, if we look in Salt Lake City, you see the River District with majority populations to the left, to the west of the I-15. This is 2000. To the east over there is Maine and Vermont. And then if we look in the 2010 census, we can see that that River District, those great increases in minority populations have concentrated in the River District. Again, on the East Bench, we still have Maine and Vermont. There's a great difference, and this is assessed property value for the county of Salt Lake. And so you can see where the affordable housing is and where the expensive housing is, remembering that housing policy is population location policy. I get all kinds of requests for, well, where are old folks going to live in the future? It depends. It depends upon housing policy. It depends upon transportation policy as well. Here we see that free and reduced lunch aid is very high in the River District from Salt Lake City. Those are people in very deep poverty. On the east side, not the case. I could be showing Orem, I could be showing Ogden, I could be showing a lot of places. Then we see in the River District non-English versus English on the east side. So we have this great difference in diversity across neighborhoods in Utah. So when you're dialing in whatever policies you're thinking about, please, my plea to you is to not think of this average, to not think of this who is the average Utah person, that there is no real average, that the average now really hides this great and emerging and growing multiplicity of who we are. And that includes the way people are living, the way that children are being raised, and the multi-generational households and so on. So we're really at this crossroads of a new era. And again, remember that we're all aspiring to grow up to be old women. That this is our goal. If we're lucky, this will be me. And, you know, it could be 10 years. It just depends on how things go. But I will end up on the beach. But when we talk about the aging of the population, let's be honest. Women outlive men. And when we look at the aging of the population just in general, look at this is the projections for Utah. That bottom line are 85-year and older people. That's the fastest growing age group we have. That top blue line are school-age folks. And the green line, those are people 60 years and older. So, you know, we are within by about 2035, 2038, thereabouts, where the number of 60-year-old people and older in Utah exceeds school-age population. And if we look at that nationally, we can see that crossover point has already passed. But again, we're about a generation and a half, maybe two generations behind the nation on so many of these metrics, but we're trending in the same direction. And, okay, this one's complicated. Deep breath. I know. I do this to people everywhere I go. I just bludgeon them with data. It's my job. Okay, this is important. This shows you, it's a summary measure of age structure. It's really important for people who are doing policy to understand this about Utah and the U.S. But the blue rectangle shows you the number of people under 18 per 100 working age people. Now, we realize people are probably going to have to work forever now, but this is working age, okay? The top square or rectangle are the number of people 65 years and older per working age person defined as 18 up to 65. If we look back in 1970, we can clearly see the post-World War II baby boom. We were 61 youth per 100 working age people. Then there were 18 elders. We entered the labor force in the 1980s and 90s were there. And as you can see, by the time you get out to 2020 and 2030 and 2040, we are occupying the red rectangle now, the old white baby boomers. And the dependency ratio, as it's called, then is increasing almost to the level it was in 1970, but this time because there are so many old folks. And to be blunt about it, there are going to be lots of old white women. Because women outlive men, and by the time we get into the older age groups, women are outnumbering men 4 and 5 to 1. So the dependency ratio here, this is nationally, you see the number of youth per working age levels out about 40 or so. Here are the data for Utah. Our youth level out component levels out at the mid-40s. So we do not see a return to those crushing dependency ratios that we did in the early 1970s. And still a number of people will talk about that we can't do something because of our unique demographics. But we will not, for the foreseeable future, return to the old Utah. The number of families that have 5 and 6 kids is becoming very, very rare. And you can see what drives our dependency ratio into the future as it is nationally. You see, we end up being very much like the nation. They're at 75.7. We're at 80. We're slightly higher on youth, but we're right there on the elder component. And that, my friends, is a lot of old women. Look at the male-to-female ratios out of the last census, and the one means there's exactly the same number as men as women, male and female, in the bottom axis are ages. And we know that there are more little boy babies born than little girl babies. There's a whole literature on this, and it's very interesting, but we don't have time to go into it. And so then you see in Utah, for some reason, there's a whole bunch of men that go missing around 19 or 20. I call that the missionary cave, and of course with the change in the mission ages and the increasing diversity of our missionary corps, we will expect the missionary cave to just not maybe disappear at some point, but become less pronounced. But what you see then is that every age after 45 for Utah and about 55 for the nation, women begin to outnumber men. You get to the oldest age groups and women are outnumbering men 4 and 5 to 1. So when we talk about the aging of the population, let's be very clear. We're talking about many, many old women, and that will be us if we're lucky. So This is the future we have emerging for ourselves. Lots of the largest demographic burden, elderly demographic burden ever. We've got this technological complexity and global competition. We're more interconnected as a species as ever before, but yet we those connections a lot of times are not clear. We understand that what we do today impacts the future. What we don't do today impacts the future. To not act, of course, is to act. And so we know Utah is forever changed. I was trying to find some pictures of women, but I ran out of time. There you go. Utah is forever changed. That great diversity occurs across race, ethnicity, language, age, household type, income inequality, rich and poor. And so as you're thinking about what to do for Utah's young women and old women, please recognize, don't plan to the average. Consider the distribution. As Stephen Gould famously said, the median is not the message. The median is certainly not the message. There is no average Utah person anymore, and we're becoming much more like the nation, much more multicultural, multiracial, multi-ethnic, and all of that plays out in particular ways for women. I'll stop.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
I know, it's a lot.
Ms. Irene.
I just have a comment. I love your presentation style. Thank you for providing all this data for us in such in your rapid fire approach. It was very good.
Thank you. But wait, there's more.
No, I'm sure you could go on, but it was, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Barnett.
Thank you. I'll be 70 in just a few months, so I'm
congratulations.
And I'm right in sync. I'm working full time. Just had my 50th class reunion where half of my class are retired and wondering why I'm still working. Well, it's because it's on the chart. That's why I'm still working. Thank you. You're fabulous.
If you have stuff that comes up, you know, this is what I do. And I love the demographic work. And like I said, we're developing this neighborhood level stuff, the community data project. If there are certain metrics you want to follow across time to follow the progress of women, just thinking, we could build some neighborhood level metrics to see, you know, if we've got some targets we want to go for. We could see how different neighborhoods, different areas of the state, whatever. And again, to be full disclosure, I've worked with Ann on the YWCA index on the well-being of women.
Madam Speaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Explain to me again why you think what's going on with what you call the missionary cave.
Oh, sure.
And why do you think it's going to go away? Are they all still going?
That is the number of males to females. Okay, so it's a ratio.
So in those years, the
males disappear and the females are still here, so there are fewer men. So there's 0.8
right.
men per one woman. At the age of 19, they go. So if you're on the number one line, what that means is there for every 100 men, there's 100 women. So there's about 103 male babies born per 100 female babies born. So that's how it starts above. And then mortality rates for men are higher. And so women start outliving men about, when you get to about 45 in years old in Utah, then there are more women than men. And by the time you get to 100 years old, there are about 5 women for every one man.
Tell that to the gentleman that my husband and I just visited a few nights ago. That's 103 this month.
Well, then he better have some really good dancing shoes.
He
right?
does, actually. He's an incredibly, he's an amazing guy. Anyway, he's almost 103. But are you saying these lines will go back closer together because, not because fewer Utah men are going on mission, because more women are going on mission.
Yes.
So the ratio will
converge.
Converge, got it.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Can we get a copy of it to publish our meeting material?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And thank you for your offer to continue to work with us. There's a lot of opportunity.
I'm your secret weapon.
Well, thank you so, thank you very much. Okay, quickly. Communications Subcommittee. We had hit on this during the last meeting, and just the ability for us to form, included in the legislation, our ability to develop subcommittees as we saw a need. A need has arisen. There have been many requests for members of this commission to speak to different groups. We're also getting to a point where there are policy needs that we've identified and agreed upon, and those will also have to be communicated. And I'd like, Ms. Thompson has also raised some issues related to this too, so I would invite her to speak, and then I would like to make a motion. Push your button, please.
Wonderful. My comment was by email, and I hope you all saw that. In speaking about the article that came out about Utah ranking lowest in the state in the union for women in leadership, and my suggestion was that we be a voice in the community, at least addressing those issues, even if we haven't solved our problems yet. I think it's important that we share with the women in the state as well as men, that we are at least addressing these issues. That was my suggestion. Rather than pretending like we heard about it but didn't really want to delve into it.
Does anyone have any questions or concerns about that? Oh, what Carrie did mention, that DWS has the staffing capability through their communications area to be able to help that group as well. Does anyone have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will move that we create a communication subcommittee of the commission and request that those members of the commission that would like to be on this subcommittee please communicate with us and let us know. I come from the legislative context, obviously, and subcommittees are usually much smaller. There are 11 members of the commission, so and sometimes in legislative subcommittees, we call them subcommittees, and many times they function as working groups. And so they, what our greatest concern is to not violate the Open and Public Meetings Act when we meet as legislators, right? So there are certain requirements about how many you can have without publicly noticing it 24 hours, those kinds of things. We're going to have to check with Carrie, I guess, on the requirements under the statute that we're operating on. I'm not advocating that we do everything possible to avoid having a public meeting. That's not my point. My point is we don't want to ever find ourselves in a place where we have inadvertently, right? So we're going to have to really follow those rules, make sure that, the subcommittee is functioning in compliance with the law and all of our deliberations. So that's my motion.
No discussion to the motion. Ms. Burkholder?
This was actually a response to Ms. Thompson about women and leadership, and I think that it's important if you or other women are serving on the communication subgroup that you become aware of other groups that are working on the issue of increasing women in leadership positions, because there are at least two efforts going on right now. Real Women Run and the Women's Leadership Project at UVU, as well as other things. So the need not to be siloed and to be unaware of what is going on in order to move the needle for women in Utah, I think will be very important for the commission and for this group.
Great suggestion. Ms. Eyring. Or no, I'm sorry. Ms. Barnum.
I
I just wanted to offer my assistance on the communication subcommittee. I would love to be part of that and to really help to create a communications plan with ideas like this, that there are so many issues that we see on a daily basis that we really could be piggybacking and become that voice for women. And I say piggybacking because we can use proactive communication techniques, but also just being aware and having our finger on the pulse of what else is out there and happening and being reported, and being that source for whether it's media or these other groups that are already actively working to communicate. Like, let's do that. Let's be there. I want to help.
Great. Thank you. Anyone else? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Great. Motion passes.
We have a subcommittee. And if you, if anyone would, anyone else would like to participate in that, then please let us know. Thank you.
I just meant to add that I would be willing to serve on the communications subcommittee.
Great. Thank you for your willingness to serve. Okay, let's go through the matrix. Jen, thanks for... does everyone have an updated copy? That was handed out, hard copy. What is the date on that? Jen, was that 10/27?
I printed it off this morning, so I don't... It's actually 11/5.
Okay. Are you working to bring it up?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Again, the intent of this is that it is a living document. If you have added things to this, please let us know. I think, Ms. Irene, have you added some things to update this?
They're on there. Gail just passed out this revised version.
Uh-huh.
The original one we got this morning did not have our updates on it from the last meeting, so this one does.
Okay, so this is... All right. Okay. Could you point out some of the items that you have highlighted?
The one that is important to me, that I brought up that is on here, is the Ms. Thompson's comments a minute ago about the Wall Street 24/7 report and the underrepresentation of women in leadership. That's on the second page. And some of Ms. Burkholder's comments were added to the matrix as well. It's mostly the second page, it looks like, that were the additions from our last meeting.
On the second. Yes, on the screen it's showing it's the last in placement, not in priority, on the horizontal line. Ms. Burkholder, did you want to point out anything? Thank you. Ms. Burkholder, did you want to point out anything in particular?
Thank you. No, I need to look at this more closely.
Okay.
I didn't have an opportunity to do that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you all for, as we identified items of interest and tools for outcome completion and coordination with other groups as well, and we, it's really important that we fill out this matrix, and thank you for your attention to it. To me, well, to all of us, it is our roadmap to our success and accountability as well, and I think that that's tremendous. And also to reward everyone for their hard work, to be able to see it and measure it. I think that's huge. We have one last item. So, Bagley had printed this cartoon, and my first thought was, well, we don't look like that. I don't. I've been talking with some of the members and had an idea, and tell me what you all think about this. How would you all like to have your photograph taken today? And we can send it to Bagley and ask him what he's thinking. with that. Although his point is well taken. I think it would be funny if we did that. So does anyone have any thoughts about that? Are you guys okay with that?
Well, we need mail that is serving the water.
Yeah,
no, we have
oh, we do. Yeah. Are you guys good with that?
Yes.
Okay, all right.
Did we get your
video?
We can do that after. If we could do a picture, we could do it with phone. We can do the video.
Okay, great. Just as long as we all wanted to participate with that as well, too.
I thank
okay.
you.
All right.
I appreciate it. Was
that the Martian Lightyear or something?
It's a Ferris Bueller. It's a Ferris Bueller. Jen, can your phone handle this?
If you can use my one, if I could.
We need a photograph, and we need, then after that, we'll need a video.
Okay. Should we?
Yeah,
can you see us okay, Jen?
Sorry, can you come? I'm gonna see the picture.
You should stop in this room.
Okay. Troy, are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Are you okay with looking like you're serving us better?
Yeah, you can press us
out some papers. Oh, that is
hilarious.
That is exactly. I'd like to go on a tribute tomorrow, Jen.
Oh my golly.
It's so good.
Get the good angle.
Yeah.
We need to look like we're in serious discussion.
Oh, that's right. Oh,
we're
very good. We all need glasses, too.
I'm laughing too much. We're very serious discussion. Good.
The speaker and I do this a lot. Stage to action photo.
Never.
What are you talking about?
Stop making that face.
Perfect.
You don't review that before you
know. No, but you got it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we work with all right, and then we need a, Jen, what do you need, or Dr. Robinson, sorry, what do you need us to do for the Ferris Bueller thing?
So I think we'll just act as if you're doing a roll call, essentially. So maybe call it Barnett, Burkholder, and then Robinson.
Just like
you want me to intro that I'm taking role or just start calling names? Do you want them to say here or? Okay.
Thank you,
ma'am.
Okay, we're rolling.
Barnett?
Here.
Burkholder?
Here.
Selig?
Here.
Thompson?
Here.
Robinson? 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 Robinson. Robinson?
You're awesome. Thank you, man.
Yes.
Okay, I think anything else pressing? Okay, we've got one more meeting under our leadership, and I think we had scheduled for 2 hours, but I'm going to see if we can, because we've got some things to go over next time. And what our goal is, what? We'll figure it out. It'll be fine. And she's freaking out about my schedule.
Wait, haven't you been told you have no schedule now?
Oh, that's right. No, that's after December 31st. So we're trying to cram everything into, like, 6 weeks. What our goal is to have the matrix very clear, have a direction set. We've talked with Dr. Robinson about compiling all the data that we have been presented up until this point, and with a synopsis of it too. So we have it as part of the record. We have it as a resource, but then we also have a usable white paper with it too to help and point in a very clear direction for the next two leaders and for the group, and then also going into the next legislative session. So that's our goal, Madam Speaker.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. What I think it would be the most useful for the legislature as it moves forward is all of that data. And then as we look at hopefully what DWS can bring us in terms of the barriers, federal barriers, state barriers, policy, law, whatever, if we can enumerate those in the white paper, that is a document that the legislature can actually use and say, look, this is out of our hands, this is an advocacy role, and this is something that we need to run a piece of legislation on, or we need to adjust a line item in how funds are appropriated. Those are actionable items that can actually move forward into the next session.
So not only legislative, but also administrative. So I think that will be really interesting with that to see what component is actually due to administrative discretion. And then the advocacy obviously takes it on a different form.
Right. So if we can get that in the next meeting, that would be...
We will. Well, you're the speaker.
Until December 31st.
Right, but we have, I mean, we're in that right now, so I think that we should ask for that. That's what I'm saying. Ms. Barnett, and then Ms. Burkholder.
Representative Seelig, I am very aware that December 31st at midnight, we lose Speaker of the House, Rebecca Lockhart, and Representative Janice Seelig. But January 1st, 2015, you're just a couple of private citizens, correct? And you can sit on this board?
We're not really sure what. I mean, we're not really sure what happens to it. Some have said that our pictures disappear from everywhere and we just don't exist anymore. I don't really know. I haven't lived through that yet, so we'll know.
You can't sit on this board.
Oh, well, no.
You don't want to, or you're not available, or you're going on another retreat, or I don't know what.
Another retreat. And that's a very good question. Thank you for asking it. The structure that was laid out in the bill and now is statute sets a particular number of people on this commission, and our two places are appointed by the Speaker of the House and as well as the Minority Leader, and they do have to be legislators, and that is something that was with clear intent in achieving. We do have the subcommittee structure that is available to us, and we can serve on that if we are wanted and if there is an area that comes up that could benefit from our expertise. So the subcommittee area is very widely defined. So whatever the commission could use that tool to the best of its ability to achieve its goals. Ms. Burkholder.
Question for clarification, Madam Chair. The distinction between statutory and administrative has come up numerous times today. Are you looking at administrative as regulatory, or is that a separate category?
I think it's
odd for you to be in charge.
I know, it feels very strange. I never let the minority party do anything. Both, okay? So there would be a formalization of that discretion via administrative rule, but also there are interactions on what could be defined as departmental policy, or even on a one-on-one interaction between a counselor and a client or a citizen. I mean, the act is telling somebody that it's not a good idea to start a pathway to a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Science or whatever, because we have limitations on funding. I'm not sure what that is. And I want to make sure that we know what that is. That could be any myriad of things. And I'm not suggesting that the intent is nefarious. I think everyone's trying to comply with the law and trying to be helpful. I think that sometimes, though, when we get on such a detailed level, it cannot have the opportunity to see the greater implications of that. So that is one example of where I'm not sure if it's formalized or not. I don't know what that is, and I think that we need to know. Madam Speaker.
Yeah, my comment would be that, I see it in the regulatory sphere in particular, because those are, as I mentioned before, those are actionable items. Remember, administrative rule, regulation, as passed in administrative rule, has the force of law. So that can be brought forward if a regulation or an administrative rule is believed to not be in compliance with legislative intent or with what's in the statute. We have an administrative rules review committee that I sit on that we hear about those things on a regular basis. I'm not suggesting that these things happening at DWS are in violation of that. I'm saying there are formalized processes to deal with those kinds of things. And maybe the rules and regulations that are creating barriers are related to and indirect compliance with statute. That's what we need to narrow down to, are these statutorily guided or required types of regulations, or is there wide berth, right, in the law, and the agencies are choosing under their jurisdiction and under their ability to have that make your own choice kind of thing. Are they making the choice to have these policies? That's what needs to be found out.
Any other final words of wisdom? Okay, thank you. And thank you all for your time. I know we've gone a little bit over. Yes, ma'am.
Not a set of the meeting, but I did put an invitation in front of each of you. It's for the Women in Business Conference. It's the 38th annual Women in Business Conference. The conference itself is free. The Athena Award Luncheon at lunchtime is $75. We are awarding an Athena and some Pathfinders for our area in the area of business. And this is actually a fundraiser for our center. So this is a great conference, lots of different things. It's not about women business owners. It is about women in business, whether it's as an employee or manager or so forth.
Thank you. Thanks, all.
Adjourn.